This is the Medicast, November 26th, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 94. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to take a moment and welcome all of you to the show tonight. Got a lot of great stuff lined up for tonight's episode, including a look at dealing with suicide attempt patients. What do you do with a patient who's suicidal? So that'll be looked at in the tip and trick of the week this week. And we'll also be looking at the drug insulin in the medication of the week, because so many of our patients are insulin dependent. It's important to understand what type of insulins there are and how it works and what to expect from a patient who has recently been taking insulin or stopped taking insulin. First of all, though, I'd like to thank everybody for checking out the show. If you're a brand new listener to the show, head on over to medicast.com, and over there you'll be able to check out all of the past episodes, as well as lists for the tips and tricks of the week and the meds of the week that have been covered in past episodes. All of that can be found there in the left-hand column at the site. And then in the middle there, you'll see all of the great extra posts and things that I put up there throughout the week, as well as you scroll down, past episodes and past posts from previous days and weeks. And of course, I want to thank all of you long-term listeners for all of your comments, all of your support, all of the information that you send to me that makes this such a community effort here at the Medicast. There's a lot of great things just on the horizon for our community here at the Medicast. And as soon as I have some things squared away, more definitely, I will be sharing that information with all of you. I hope everybody in the United States had a great Thanksgiving holiday. I know that I did, and it's good to get back in the saddle again, though, and get some things done as we head into finishing out the rest of the year. The link of the week this week is going to be looking at another podcast, and I've linked to this podcast before. Dr. Mike over at the Pediacast podcast has been a guest on this program, and Dr. Mike interviewed an author of a book about vaccines. This author is another pediatrician, and he kind of gives just some straight information to parents on vaccines. And it's a great, easy-to-read book. Dr. Mike interviewed this gentleman on his program. I urge you to listen to it because I think it's a different take on the whole vaccine debate. Dr. Mike and this other physician really have a position that says they are not going to force parents to vaccinate their children, but rather educate parents so that they can make a truly well-informed decision. And I got to agree with that. I think that knowledge is power. And a lot of times the reason parents aren't vaccinating their children is because they're afraid, because they've gotten erroneous information, or they haven't completely understood the information that they have gotten. So check out this link of the week with Dr. Mike's Pediacast interview, and I think you'll really enjoy what you hear. Let's move on into this week's news. And I'll lead off the news story with another item of great news about an EMS provider who was aware of their protocols, who was able to use their protocols to bring back somebody from death or from death's door. And, you know, we take so many patients so many times that are just routine transports. There's really nothing, no significant improvement in care as far as their condition by the time we get to the hospital or to our final destination. The patient's pretty much the same as they were when we picked them up. And I guess maintaining their health is something we can be proud of. But I like to point out that the reason we work so hard and the reason that we study and do things like those of you who listen to this podcast are all because of the incidents that come up rarely. The incidents that pop up on our radar where we are called upon to perform truly life-saving interventions. The story I have here is from England, and it's a story about a premature baby. He was born 14 weeks premature. Think about that. That's a 26-week preemie, okay? And this baby was so tiny that he was weakly squeaking, crying, I guess, after birth. The child was born at the hands of a 4-year-old sister while a person gave them instructions over the phone to the mother and the daughter. And yet when the paramedic, first man on the scene, got there, he had to administer about 4 or 5 minutes of CPR to this infant to begin getting a response back after it started to expire. And again, it's that reviewing of your protocols, going back and looking at what's the CPR protocol for neonates? What's the CPR protocol for breaths and ventilations and everything else that we do? All of these things are the reasons we have to go through all the training and continuing ed that we do, because we need to be prepared for just this kind of call. And so I'm going to say kudos to the paramedic in this story and make sure that this paramedic is not left along the side. His name is Rob Bentley. He's a UK paramedic, and he did the job that he needed to do. Speaking of training, you know, there's always stories out there in the news, I report on them all the time, about paramedic shortages, EMT shortages. Where are we going to get the personnel we need to man the shifts that are out there? And I always point out different organizations or agencies that are doing what they can to try to increase this process. And here we go, another organization, actually a company that runs American Ambulance, the American Professional Educational Group, which is part of the Norwich, Connecticut American Group Company, has proposed to the state of Connecticut that they begin offering a fast-tracked paramedic program for experienced EMTs. Basically, this is going to take a traditional paramedic program, which usually runs about 12 to 18 months, and they're going to boil it down to a full-time field-based education program in 5 months' time. American Ambulance claims that there is not an issue immediately with their workforce and their availability of qualified personnel to staff their units, but the national shortage can affect everybody. And they believe that there are more paramedics showing up in emergency rooms, in doctor's offices, and fire departments are hiring more ALS providers as well. So that these paramedics they're training may end up working for them, or they may end up working in a non-traditional EMS field like those just listed. So this program is going to look at having a full-time class program, 1,200 hours of class instruction, along with hospital clinicals and extensive training in the field. And then all participants must pass national registry exams for certification before getting a state license in Connecticut. So just another way that you can look at getting training. And for organizations and managers and folks out there that are listening, you can use programs like this or work with your local community colleges, your local fire academies, and perhaps find a way to partner with them in getting the job done in a similar way. Moving right along, I'm going to extend a hearty congratulations to one of my own senior medical directors, Dr. Robert Bass, who is one of the head honchos at the Maryland Institute of Emergency Medical Services, the agency that produces my protocols and oversees my training here in Maryland, has been honored by the American College of Emergency Physicians during a recent conference they had in Seattle. He has been recognized for outstanding contributions to EMS. And this is a great honor. I know he's very active in both state programs as well as federal programs and international programs. And it's great to have one of our own be recognized. Dr. Bass is sometimes criticized, but I think he ultimately runs an excellent program that offers free statewide EMS training, at least to the EMTB level, has a statewide protocol that means that he can send instructors anywhere in the state, and it's always the same wherever he goes, oversees both volunteer and commercial ambulance services in his agency's oversight and still manages to find time to be an excellent ER doctor and trauma doctor in that setting, working at Baltimore's University of Maryland Shock Trauma Hospital. And so I'd like to just again extend a congratulations to Dr. Bass. And I think it speaks well for all of us here in Maryland that we have someone that's so recognized in that position. Finally, I'll wrap up with a story that comes to us from Tokyo. I found this one over at emsresponder.com, and it's a story about a new triage system that was implemented there about 3 or 4 months ago in an effort to try to alleviate some of the ambulance overuse by patients who were not necessarily in need of ambulance transportation. The triage situation was supposed to have crews determine in the field whether a patient really needed to go to the hospital or whether they could wait until seeing a primary care physician or another resource. And this program did not have the results that they were hoping it would have, and primarily because there didn't seem to be any effect hardly at all. They were looking for maybe a 7% reduction in transports, and they had just a 0.06 reduction in transports. We're talking a very, very minute decrease in transports when you're talking about 0.06%. And so this is something that I guess they could just scrap and say, oh, well, it didn't work. But I got to give them kudos for staying with it. They're going to re-examine the program. One of the things that they think may be the cause is having their ambulance attendants be overly risk averse, worried about, I guess in our situation in the United States, perhaps liability. Are you going to send a patient home that indeed does have a major issue and ends up dying? Or are you going to, there's just any number of reasons why you wouldn't want to send someone back to their house and not take them to the hospital unless you were 100% sure. And come on, how often are we 100% sure of anything? So they're going to go back and look at redrafting the program with some very definite protocols saying, if you see this, this, and this, they stay home. It's not going to even give the choice as much up to the people on the units. And I think this has got some merit to it. We all see patients all the time that are not necessarily in need of emergency transport. And sometimes we become callous towards them. Sometimes we become callous towards them when they're not there. We talk about them derisively when we get back to the station. And it's something important for us to remember that this isn't our emergency. This is their emergency. They feel that there's a reason they need to see a doctor at that time. And it is very real as a problem to them. It may not seem like much to us because of our experience, but to them, it's very serious. Sometimes all they need is a medical provider to talk with them and give them some information and give them an assessment and let them make an informed decision. And I think that a program like this, with appropriate protocol backup and medical backup online and, you know, by phone or whatever, all can go a long way towards helping people to make that kind of an informed decision in the field and perhaps take some of the load off from our services. I'd rather spend an extra 5 minutes with a patient in their house, giving them a better, fuller examination, and then turning around and calling medical command and getting permission to instruct them to stay home. And then I'm back on the street faster for that next call that may be more critical. Other than that, I'm going to end up tying up an extra 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, transporting to the hospital, restocking my unit, and then getting back into my service district in a timely fashion. So all of this can do a lot to help out with overcrowding in our ERs and overuse of our ambulance services. And it's interesting to see that that's a problem all around the world, not just in the United States. The news is done, and that means it's time for this week's tip and trick of the week. You know, with the holidays coming up, it's going to be more and more evident for some people that they are facing major depression. And we may run into more and more patients who are dealing with the stresses of the holidays, with the depression that affects many during the holidays. And we may see an increase in suicide attempts, in dangerous and risky behaviors that may be a sideways version of suicide attempt. And we need to maybe have a better understanding of this particular problem in mental illness that we might see in the field over the coming weeks and months. So I'm going to look at that here. I have some links in the show notes I urge you to go check out. They're both situated at the National Institutes of Health, and the primary link I'll be using is from the National Institutes of Mental Health here in the United States. So let's look at this largely preventable problem. Suicide is a major preventable public health problem. In 2004, it was the 11th leading cause of death in the United States, accounting for 32,439 deaths. This is an overall rate of about 10.9 deaths per 100,000 people. However, it is estimated that 8 to 25, depending on which studies you look at, between 8 and 25 people attempt suicide for every successful suicide death. It's very complex to understand the reasoning behind suicide. There may be an underlying mental illness, perhaps an acute mental illness, such as a sudden onset of a depression or other problem, or there may be a chronic mental illness at fault that is contributing to the suicide or suicide attempt. But what are some of the specific risk factors? First of all, depression and mental disorders. Also, substance abuse is strongly indicated as a risk factor. More than 90% of people who die by suicide have just these three things occurring as a risk factor. Other risk factors include stressful life events, prior suicide attempts, family history of mental disorder or substance abuse, family history of suicide, any violence in the family, including physical or sexual abuse, the presence of firearms in the home. More than 50% of all suicides are by gunshot wound. Also, a history of incarceration and exposure to the suicidal behavior of others. And this comes back to the idea that is suicide contagious? If there's a media presentation of a suicide in the paper, does this induce others to think of suicide as a viable option for the stressors in their life? And I'd have to say that there is some evidence to back this up. I provide a link in the show notes that gives some more information on this, and also some information that you can give out to your local media on how to report suicides more responsibly so that it is not presented in an attractive way for patients to have as an option. Men are more likely to commit suicide than women. Suicide is the 8th leading cause of death for males and the 16th leading cause of death for females. So there's almost 4 times as many males as females die by suicide. Males are most often likely to use firearms for suicide, whereas females seem to be split pretty evenly between firearms and poisoning. Also followed up by suffocation, at such as hanging and poisoning, as other options for both genders. Children and young people are increasingly at risk for death by suicide. Children's ages 10 to 14 seem to be at a lower risk with 1.3 per 100,000. However, once children reach adolescence and on into young adulthood up to age 24, their risk factors increase significantly, from 8.2% for the adolescent to 12.5% for the young adult. So what do we do to respond to a patient who has attempted suicide? Obviously, when you respond to a suicide itself, a successful suicide, you're dealing with a person who is presumed dead on arrival. Perhaps resuscitative events are indicated. But let's not look at that. Let's look at the patient who has survived their suicide attempt. First of all, you deal with the underlying attempted cause. You need to find out exactly what they did to try to kill themselves. Was it taking pills? Then you need to deal with a poisoning. Was it a hanging? Then you might need to deal with asphyxia or neck cervical trauma. Gunshot wounds have their own multi-system trauma approach that you need to come around with. However, there's another underlying treatment that we need to be aware of. The treatment that we extend to somebody in a way that deals with the reason they tried to kill themselves. And we can do a lot just in our initial response and attitude towards them when we get on the scene. If they're conscious and alert, we can not be judgmental. People who commit suicide do so, or attempt suicide, do so because they are in extreme distress. Okay? This is not, and it's been shown by study after study, suicide attempts are not just bids for attention. They are people who have seen no other option to get out of the problems in their life than to go ahead and try to kill themselves. So the understanding or the thought process or the cliche that, oh, they just want somebody to pay attention to them, I'm not going to treat them well so they don't want to do this again. Well, if you treat a person who just tried to commit suicide like crap, you are reinforcing that suicidal behavior. There's no other way around it. You know, if you had a patient who was in impending cardiac arrest, but you had started to stabilize them, you wouldn't go ahead and give them epi anyway. You're doing the same thing when you have somebody who's attempted suicide and you decide that you're going to make a judgment about them as a person rather than treating them with compassion as a patient. So this is something I feel very strongly about, in case you can't tell. And I just want to just make an impression upon you that how we treat the suicide attempt patient can go a long way towards determining whether or not they end up seeking some of the help they need after they've been hospitalized. So this is going to be one of those deep breath moments. If you feel yourself starting to get angry at the person, if you feel yourself starting to want to make a snide comment, I want you to stop, take a deep breath, and remember a time when you just really had a crappy day. All right? You didn't need somebody coming along and giving you grief about it. So turn on your professional EMS demeanor and go ahead and get some key assessment and history questions done so that you can get this patient started talking. And talking is what they need to do. They need to get some strong and in-depth therapy to get behind why they made this decision. And your professional openness can help them start talking, and they'll continue talking when they get to the emergency room. You can ask the question, have you ever tried to do this before? Did you mean to hurt yourself? They may deny it, but most of them are going to be honest and say, yeah. You may want to do this, especially with parents of, with young children or teenagers that have done this. You don't want to do this in front of their parents because their parents are going to try to fix it or punish it. Get them in the back alone and start talking to them. Ask them those questions. Ask them if they had a plan and how long they'd had that plan. And then ask them, what were you thinking about? What made you make the decision to go through with this today? And then listen, okay?
Listen.
You're good listeners, I can tell, because I never hear back from you when I'm talking. You just need to be that person to sit there and be a set of ears, okay? You don't necessarily need to do a lot of invasive follow-up with them. If they seem to be stable and you can get away with just taking an occasional vital sign, blood pressure and whatnot, and they don't have any other critical interventions needed, then leave them their personal space. Don't be all up in their face. And get them to the hospital and provide for them the treatment that they need, started in the field, and then get them into the hospital where they can finish that treatment program that you have professionally started. I urge you to check out the links that I have in the show notes. There's just a wealth of information, more than I can really go over here. There are just tons of links that are associated with those links that I'm sending you to. So you can find out just about anything you need to find out about suicide, suicide rates, and suicide prevention through the links that I have in the show notes for this episode. Let's jump into this week's Med of the Week. And the Med of the Week this week is going to be insulin. A lot of our patients are insulin-dependent diabetics, and there are many different types of insulin that have different profiles of action, and it's really important that we have at least a basic understanding of the action of insulin in the body and what types of insulin are out there and how it should be handled. And we may have an indication of why our diabetic patients may be experiencing problems when we get on the scene based upon this understanding. Insulin is a naturally produced hormone that is used by our bodies as a way to process glucose at the cellular level. We can't take glucose into our cells for metabolism until insulin's there to help it across the cell membrane. It's produced in the pancreas by the beta cells in the islets of Langerhans. Everybody, islets of Langerhans, right? Remember, the beta cells are complement to the alpha cells. The alpha cells produce glucagon, the other hormone produced in the pancreas for glucose metabolism. The way I remember that is alpha cells starts with an A, and glucagon has an A in it. Insulin does not have an A in it, so it must be the beta cells. So that's the way I remember which one comes from where, and that's a little extra tip for you. Insulin used to be produced primarily as a byproduct of beef and pork metabolism. So this was produced, they produced the insulin and then it was drawn off and used by humans. However, that is no longer the case. And in fact, specialized bacterial cells and other microbes are used to produce insulin now. Basically, implanting a gene into a single-celled creature that produces human insulin. It's a human gene, and then letting that single-celled creature produce all the insulin you need. There are more than 20 different types of insulin products available in four basic forms. And the key difference between the four different forms has to do with the time of onset and the duration of action. How quickly does it take effect and how long does it work? And how long is its peak time? How quickly does it get to its peak time? Different types of insulin have different effects, and different people's personal version of diabetes can be treated differently depending on person to person. One person might have to take fast and rapid acting insulins. Another person's body may be able to handle using a longer, slow time-release version of insulin. The different types of insulin include rapid-acting insulins like Humalog or Novolog, and these begin acting within 15 minutes of injection and have a duration that lasts up to 3 to 5 hours. Regular insulin, also known by some of the brand names Humulin R and Novolin R, R being regular, has an onset of action in 30 minutes to an hour and lasts 5 to 8 hours. Then you have your intermediate acting and long acting insulins. The long intermediate acting insulins have an onset of 1 to 3 hours and a duration of up to 20 to 24 hours. And your long acting insulins are having an onset period of 4 to 8 hours up to 36 hours. There are mixtures, so people might get a mixture of a short-acting or a regular insulin mixed with a longer-acting insulin, one to deal with the meal you're just getting ready to eat, and the other one to deal with what you're going to be having down the road, maybe snacks or whatever. And again, these different formulations are figured up for the patients on an individual basis, and then the different formulations are prescribed that way. The medication is usually delivered by subcutaneous injection. A lot of diabetics will inject either into the subcutaneous fat in their abdomens or in the upper arm in the region of the deltoid muscle. Other types of infusions may occur. The only insulin that is available for IV infusion is regular insulin. So if you were, for some reason, involved in providing an IV drip insulin, you would want to use a regular insulin, not any of the rapid acting or the intermediate or long acting, only the short acting insulins. And this is the regular insulin. Other ways that it's infused is through insulin pumps. Insulin pumps are increasingly prevalent, and this is something you might want to look for in a motor vehicle accident with altered mental status. Often, this is worn on the hip, kind of like a large pager or a PDA or a BlackBerry looks like, in a black case on the belt, and it delivers an insulin infusion directly into the body that way via a small tube. This insulin pump can be dislodged during some kind of traumatic event like a motor vehicle accident, and you may have a patient with altered mental status who is an insulin-dependent diabetic, and they've just lost their insulin pump. You need to recover that. It's an expensive piece of equipment, and transport it with them to the hospital. Do not try to reconnect it. Even if they want to, it may have sustained damage and not be able to give a normal dose. So we need to get them to the hospital regardless, but we do want to recover that if necessary. You also see insulin pens. Insulin pens are basically subcutaneous injection devices that have like a metered dose effect. They're kind of, think about an inhaler, think about a nitroglycerin spray. These insulin pens basically work the same way. They have a pre-measured dose of insulin. They have little subcutaneous needles that screw onto the end. They take off the cap, they dial up their dose, and they go ahead and administer to themselves. And then they take the sharp off and throw it in the sharps container, recap the pen, and they have it for the next day. Generally, these each carry about 100 units of insulin, and you may have a patient that receives, let's say, 6 to 8 units or less, maybe, as a normal dose. And so you can see that that would be a cost-effective way to use insulin. Insulin usually needs to be refrigerated, so it's something to keep track of. If you have a patient with altered mental status, you know what? Send somebody into the kitchen, check their refrigerator, and see if they've got insulin in the fridge being stored. That may be an indicator for you to check on. Anyway, this is just a quick overview of insulin and what you might look for in the field or in a hospital setting if you're working there. Just a quick overview of insulin and how it works. If you have any further questions, check out the links in the show notes. Everything that you need can be found there. And I think that's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show. I hope this information is valuable to you. And I want to urge you all to come back and listen again next week to the next episode. If you'd like to contribute a comment or a suggestion for a med or a tip of the week, or you want to make a correction, maybe I said something wrong or need more information, please send that to me here by email at podmedic@mac.com. Or even better, why don't you help out the show and send in a voicemail comment? You can do that by calling 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC, and you can leave a message right there for the MedicCast. I will maybe play your message here on the air. Please leave an email address at the very end. That way, if I have any questions or need clarification, I can go ahead and email you directly. Don't worry, I'll chop it off before I send it out. With the holidays fast approaching, don't forget the MedicCast store is sitting there waiting for you. If you like to do some of your shopping online at Amazon.com, you can get that same great Amazon pricing and service and do it through the MedicCast website store. That's at store.medicast.com. You can go over there. I've selected some items for you, but you can always search for anything that you might want to look for at Amazon and purchase it. Get some of your Christmas shopping done and help out the MedicCast at the same time over at store.medicast.com. All right, enough of me talking. It's time to close out the show. I want to remind all of you, make sure you share the MedicCast with somebody you know this coming week. Let other folks know about the great stuff you hear about in the MedicCast. I hear time and again from people who are EMS students or EMS providers that they kind of surprise people when they come up with some of the information that I'm able to send out to you here. Let them know you found out some of your knowledge here at the MedicCast and share the MedicCast with the rest of the EMS community. I'll wrap up now with some PodSafe music from an artist by the name of Jill Parr. Played some of Jill's music before, and you know, it's getting on towards the Christmas holidays, and since that's what we celebrate here in the Davis household, I'm going to start running some Christmas music here through the end of the year. And Jill has a great song, a great version of the old classic, Do You Hear What I Hear? Check it out, and if you like what you hear, let her know you heard it here on the Medicast. I'm Jamie Davis. Until next week, Scene Safety, BSI.
To us.